Well, I've been in leadership positions ever since I was in college, back when my friends elected me to lead our student-led campus ministry. It was a great experience and, at the same time, a really hard experience. And as much as I loved it, I told myself that I would never go into Christian leadership. So I ended up becoming a youth pastor and eventually a pastor. There you go. Now, what I've learned over the years is that leadership would be really easy if it just weren't for all the people. I've also learned that a lot of the challenges in leadership aren't really about the people. They're about what happens between the people. The challenges are about our relationships, about our system of relationships. I've learned that one person's anxiety can infect not only an entire leadership team, but even an entire church. And I've seen one person's non-anxiety restore that same team back to a state of calm and reason. Well, in this episode, I'm speaking with Steve Cuss, the author of Managing Leadership Anxiety. It's a fantastic conversation about the way anxiety can affect not only ourselves, but all of those around us. We also talk about something called family systems theory, which has to do with recognizing and managing the anxiety in a system of relationships, whether it's a family, a church, a business, a baseball team, a school. These concepts are so critical for healthy spiritual leadership, and I'm so excited to share with you our conversation as we unpack these concepts. I'm Marcus Watson, and this is episode 47 of Spiritual Life and Leadership. All right. Hi, everyone. I'm here with Steve Cuss, who is the pastor of Discovery Christian Church and the author of Managing Leadership Anxiety. Hi, Steve.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well.
Good. Well, I'm excited to have you here on this podcast, Spiritual Life and Leadership. And I'm excited to talk to you today about your book and about family systems and how just the different ways that as leaders we can manage our anxiety. But I want to start with a couple of questions, three questions that just to kind of get to know you a little bit. And so my first question is, Steve, what job would you be terrible at?
Oh, man. I've often thought when I go through an airport and you go through the TSA security guys, I've often thought, man, I would be so bad at any job where you're paid to be paranoid.
You know?
I'm kind of a raging optimist to a point of, blissful ignorance almost.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd be any good at mistrusting people to be good at my job. So I'd say TSA agent.
Okay,
plus,
good.
Cavity searches, I'd just happy to
talk. Yeah, right. That's great. Okay, second question. What would a mirror opposite of yourself be like?
Mirror opposite of me. Well, wow. So born in Northern Hemisphere, I would probably be, if I'm truly literally thinking mirror opposite, I bet I would be like a Japanese, be like a Japanese introvert.
Okay.
Who is very, very quiet, very studious, very comfortable with one foot in front of the other kind of job. That's probably who I'd be. And I guess I'd be a woman.
Okay, right.
Really go in the mirror.
Sure.
I'd be a Japanese factory working woman who's just very faithful and diligent at the same task every day.
Okay. And so let's see, what does that say about you? So you're from Australia, Southern Hemisphere, you're a white male.
White guy. Yep. Because the world needs more white men.
That's
voices.
Right. Yep. That's right. There's not enough of us.
That's right.
And, and then, so what do you mean by studious? What does that make you? You go with a flow. Tell me about that.
I'm not particularly organized. You know, I tend to have more ideas than time.
Oh, okay.
So I tend to have a mild form of chaos surrounding me as a leader, I would say. Yeah, this would be a good question for my team.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea, actually.
Yeah,
I hadn't even thought about that in terms of team. Yeah.
Yeah, they would probably enjoy a mirror opposite of me once in a while, I'm sure.
That's great. Okay, well, good. Third question then is, if your life was a book, what would its title be?
Like my memoir biography kind of life?
Yeah, or whatever, whatever it might be. Yeah.
Oh, it's hard. So on a purely human level, I think it would have to be called like a fortunate life. I think I've just been deeply and profoundly blessed.
Cool.
Yeah, professionally, I mean, it's probably called what my book is called. It would be some form of, I guess if I had to name it again, it'd be some kind of like how to lead as a human being, you know?
Yeah.
Like fascinated with leaders bringing their full humanity into their work and not compartmentalizing. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Bringing their full humanity into your work. Well, so then that's a great transition then to talking about what we're going to talk about today. Why don't you start by telling us just kind of about yourself, your spiritual, your journey in life, including your spiritual journey and not that those are separate really. And then kind of how you found yourself immersed in, you know, thinking and learning about managing anxiety and family systems and all of that. And yeah, if you tell us your story.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So I grew up in Western Australia. Great, great place to be born and raised, great family, but not a churched family. Not just my immediate family, but none of my extended family are church people either. In fact, I would say majority of my family, at least at the time in the 1980s, they would say that Christians are dumb. You know, they're obviously not intelligent like non-church people, and they're weak. They need a religious crutch to manage their life. So when my sister became a follower of Christ, that really put a wrench in our family. She's older than me. And when she was a teenager, she became a Christian. And then she led me to Christ. And it definitely disrupted our household that there's two of us, there's mom and dad and two kids. And my parents are amazing people, but this was a left field thing for them. And then man, for me to then come back to them a few years later, like I became a Christian when I was 14. Okay. And then when I was 17, I really sensed a call from God to be a pastor. And, I got to give my parents so much credit for how they blessed a child that they didn't really understand or agree with, you know, like that's pretty remarkable. So yeah, I came to my parents and said, hey, I really think God's calling me to be a pastor. And fast forward a few years, I just got a job for a few years to raise some money for college. And then I moved to America to get my theological degree because my options at home were limited. Plus, Aussies are generally adventurous. My parents had lived overseas for several years when they first got married. My sister had traveled the world. So it's kind of a thing. We all kind of go and walk about. So I moved to America to study and did my undergrad in Bible and preaching. And was facing a marriage. I was engaged, and I needed 1 year of income. My wife was going to have one more year of school, and so I kind of stumbled into becoming a trauma chaplain. And that's a whole long story that I won't bore you with. But I wasn't qualified, and I was too young. I didn't have the master's degree required, but they offered me the job anyway. And so I was this young 20-something kid, really, immediately thrust into a world of trauma and death multiple times a day. So some days you just work 8 to 5, and then several days a month you'd work from 8 in the morning until noon the next day. You'd do these overnight shifts. You kind of see them on hospital dramas on the TV show. And one of the chaplains that led the whole operation was a family systems theorist.
Okay.
And he was actually a student of Murray Bowen, who's probably best known for founding family systems theory.
Yeah.
And then he went to class with a guy named Ed Friedman, who's probably Murray Bowen's most famous student. So at 24, I got a heavy dose of systems theory from George, the supervisor. And I got a heavy dose of anxiety from being in rooms of high anxiety and noticing how I got anxious in the, and that's kind of how my whole journey started. And I've been on that journey ever since.
Wow. I understand. The feeling of being in a hospital surrounded by death and the anxiety that creates. I did a CPE as well. And I can remember sitting or standing in a room in like 25 years old and thinking, I have no idea what to do with this family whose son had just accidentally shot himself with, you know, playing around with a gun. I'm like, I have nothing to offer here. Can you give us an example of something like that? Like a moment where you came to, I don't know, some kind of an understanding of what you do or don't have to offer or don't have to offer or You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Totally. Yeah. I mean, your example, I think, is a great example. That happens so many times. My very first call, my very first day on the job was a 28-hour overnight shift. And my very first call was a family where the matriarch had unexpectedly died in surgery. And I walked into a room of about 12 or 15 people just screaming at the top of their lungs, losing their mind. One lady was headbutting a wall in a rhythm. One was dry heaving and vomiting. It was just, it was nuts.
Oh my gosh.
And my background was sales. From deciding to become a pastor to go into college, I worked for 3.5 years in sales in Australia, and I was a successful salesman. It's actually, it's a whole other story, but it's actually the very first thing in my life I've ever felt good at. I was kind of an average kid, and I was average academically, and I didn't know how to talk to girls in school, and I wasn't great at sport. So, you know, when you're a teenager, that's kind of all you have. Yeah. But I was really good at sales. So it was interesting to me that chaplaincy was the first time in my adult life where what I had, the tools in my tool belt were useless. Mm. Like, you can't manage it. You can't. And this is where my journey with anxiety began, is to notice that the very impulse that I have to do something isn't actually to serve these people. It's to manage my own anxiety. Like, the reason I'm trying to speak to them, or the reason I'm giving them a scripture right now, actually isn't to serve them. It's because I can't handle the internal pressure to do something.
Right, right.
And that manifest, that, so that wasn't a moment for me. I would say that was, because, you know, I was full-time as a chaplain. I would say that was a 12-week journey of slowly understanding, oh man, everything I think I'm doing that's right is actually wrong. And I just say, Marcus, now that I'm a lead pastor, it's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not just in times of high trauma. So much of a leader's impulse to do something is to manage ourselves, not to serve the person. And so I've now become fascinated, and obviously written a book on how to help you understand the difference. When are you actually serving someone, and when are you managing your own anxiety and not serving them? So it was it was an absolute gift. That whole year was an incredible gift.
That's good. Can you give us kind of a definition or an understanding of what do you mean when you say anxiety? Like, how can we understand that word?
Yeah, because anxiety is obviously a broad word. So in family systems theory, there's two forms of anxiety. And the first form is acute anxiety. And that's not what we're talking about. So acute anxiety is when you're in actual danger, when the danger is short term, and then you get over it. So, for example, I was home, and my two boys, my wife had taken my kids out for a walk, and this is years ago, and my kids are super young. And my two boys come sprinting through the door back from the walk, out of breath. And I thought they were in a race. You know, they're brothers. And I'm like, oh, were you guys having a race? And they said, no, we saw a snake. And I said, oh, because I think snakes are amazing. And I said, what kind of snake was it? And they said, we don't know. Mom just said, run for your lives. Because my wife is terrified of snakes. That's acute anxiety. Not that she was actually under threat. It was probably a garter snake. But the threat is real, and it's short term.
Yeah.
And so, like, if you're driving on the interstate and the person in front slams on their brakes and you get that reaction, that's acute anxiety.
Yeah, but
what family systems theory is interested in is chronic anxiety. Okay. And as I've been teaching this, I always enjoy the people who misunderstand when they'll say to me, well, I'm not a very anxious person. And that's because they think anxiety is worry and fear, and they don't worry much, and they're not afraid of much. But chronic anxiety is whatever happens next after you don't get what you think you need. So it's not short term, it's long term, it's chronic, it's always with you. And it's not an actual threat, it's a perceived threat. So in a chaplaincy environment, I believe the lie in the early days that I had to have an answer. You know, if somebody's screaming at the top of their lungs, how could God allow this to happen?
Yeah,
I believe the lie they're actually asking an intellectual question. And because I was trained in Bible college, I was actually trained with answers. I believe that I had to give an answer. And when I didn't do that, I got anxious. So every one of us have anywhere between 15 and 50 perceived needs in our life. Like, I believe I need the last word. I believe that more words from me will help you understand me. So I believe that I need to be understood. But that's actually not true. Like, I can actually survive and thrive being misunderstood by somebody.
Okay.
And so chronic anxiety is that impulse that happens next when you're not getting what you think you need. So, for example, Marcus, you know, we've already mentioned that we're both a couple of white guys. Mansplaining, it's always an anxious response.
Yeah, good.
But sometimes binging Netflix on a couch, even though it looks like you're chilling, sometimes that, and it's not always an anxious response. Sometimes it's genuinely refreshing, but that can be an anxious response. You don't realize you're worried, but you're just numbing out. So,
yeah. Interesting. And then addictions could also be anxious responses it sounds to me. Yeah.
That's a great example, because anxiety actually acts just like an addiction, where you think you're managing it, but it actually has you in its grip and it's constricting you over time.
Yeah. Now that reminds me of something that I heard in your podcast, by the way. We didn't mention that you also have a podcast called Managing Leadership Anxiety, and you talked about anxiety as a pet, or one of your kids did. It was a conversation between you and your family. And can you talk about anxiety as a pet?
Yes, I'd love to. So that was actually a guest of mine named Laura Turner. Laura is a journalist. Her parents are quite well known, John Ortberg and Nancy Ortberg. And John and Nancy are both amazing communicators, and Laura and actually Laura's brother Daniel are all incredible communicators. Anyway, Laura came on the show and very bravely shared about her journey with generalized anxiety disorder. She actually has a clinical disorder that she battles. I don't battle that. And boy, she was so helpful, and she's the one who first mentioned how it helps her to go from seeing it as this monster that's out to get her, and she kind of mentally shrinks it down to a pet on a leash that's an ever-present companion. And on my family show, I think it was my wife that was referencing that was a helpful tool.
Yeah. And you or one of your family members said something about, you know, is my pet, my anxiety, taking me for a walk, or am I taking my anxiety for a walk? And I thought, wow, that's a great way of looking at it, because, man, sometimes my anxiety has taken me not just for a walk, but for a run, and that's barely keep up.
And it's exhausting you. Yeah. I used to work at a church in Las Vegas, and I did a lot of work there with domestic violence survivors. And I've used that as a metaphor. Like, people who are trapped in domestic violence, they really wonder if they can ever be free of this dominant, aggressive personality. And when I teach anxiety seminars and workshops, I try to help people see this chronic anxiety, it's an abusive relationship you're in with. Like, you've gotten too accustomed to it. You've gotten too used to how anxiety treats you, but it never treats you well. It's always a harsh taskmaster. So in my life, anxiety primarily shows up in thinking. I tend to worry. And the lie I believe is that I can worry my way to peace, that more thinking will make me at peace. And that's anxiety pulling me down like a dark path of bad news.
Yeah. So what do you do if you start to feel anxiety like that, or you recognize the chronic anxiety that's kind of emerging in a moment? How do you respond to that?
That's a great question. Yeah. Yeah. Podcasts are a tricky medium, because I actually teach a class in a church that is 8 months. And so shrinking it down to 30 minutes can be challenging. Yeah. So I'm happy to answer, so long as our listeners understand this is a long journey, and I'm going to make it sound more simple than it really is. But the first step is, if you can begin to notice where anxiety begins. Because most of us don't know we're anxious until we're too far gone, and then we're already in its grip. So step one is to actually name out loud to somebody where your anxiety begins. So on my podcast, if you know, you've probably heard it, we ask every guest the same question. Does it start in a spinning mind, a racing heart, or a tightening gut? And so if your listeners could say, okay, for me, it's a racing heart. That's how I know I'm anxious. That's step one. And then step two is just to shift your life, literally. Like, you can do this now listening and say, what if I live my life where I no longer tolerated anxiety? Like, I just, What if I treated it like a harsh taskmaster, like an abusive relationship? It's always got me on bad news. And I write about this extensively in the book about the false self and how anxiety is evidence that we're actually depending on bad news, not good news. But that would be the next shift. And then, and oftentimes you do need a friend to help you. You actually need to externalize out, like you need to say it. If you can name to a friend, what are two or three things that I think I need that I don't really need? Like in my case, I need to be liked. I've got a friend of mine. He needs to always get it right the first time. Now, these are needs that aren't actually needs. Like I can live with people not liking me. He can live getting it wrong. In fact, in his case, I won't share his name, but in his case, he'll actually damage the organization he leads because he's being too cautious, because he's operating out of the need to always be right and get it right because he has a perfectionist streak.
Right.
But he'll actually serve his organization better if he takes more risks and fails more, you know?
Okay.
So this is just a few simple ways where our anxiety has us by its grip and it's actually affecting us and our families or our organizations.
Yeah.
And then there's deeper work after that, but that'd be the first three steps.
Sure. That's great. That's helpful. The anxiety we've been talking about so far is kind of more personal for the in the individual, but then there's also a broader anxiety in an organization or a group of some kind, and that's where family systems kind of comes in. Can you talk about that, the connection between anxiety and family systems and what that all means?
Yeah. Family systems theory is so good. So 1954, Mary Bowen is a psychiatrist and he's working in a psych ward. And this was the first moment where he noticed that our problems aren't just inside us. He was observing paranoid schizophrenics on parent visitation day. So he'd had these young men in their 20s, schizophrenic. They're in the psych ward. Mom and dad had come and visit. And as he noticed the way they related, a light bulb went on. And he basically started this whole new field where he said, oh, our problems aren't just inside us. They're also between us. So the way we relate to each other also generates anxiety. I'll be so bold as to say I've since come along and I've actually tried to do some work in my book to say it's also environmental. There are 18 environments that if you're in these 18 environments, it's going to generate anxiety. I'll give you one right now. Like if you're in a job and you have all this responsibility and no power, that's an environment that will make you anxious. And it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you or that, you know, you have an issue with your dad from childhood. It's simply that there's an imbalance between responsibility and power. And you will stay anxious until that imbalance is rectified or until you leave. Classic example would be an interim pastor who comes in.
Okay.
And the church has systemic toxic problems. And the interim pastor has all this responsibility, but no power to change it and ends up becoming the scapegoat, you know. That interim pastor is going to be anxious and it's not their fault. It's not because they're a sensitive person. But what Bowen did is he started to say, let's get families together and let's look at how mom and dad and the kids relate to each other. And let's look at the way they relate as much as what they're saying to each other. That's really the genius of family systems. So if our listeners were to picture that every one of us is carrying around a bucket of anxiety, if you just kind of picture that you have all this anxiety you're holding in a bucket, and let's say your dad loses his temper at you because he had a bad day at work. He has now spilled his anxiety into you, and your bucket is now overflowing, and you can't carry it anymore, so you have to dump it on someone else. And so anxiety then in any group of people becomes contagious. We all catch each other's anxiety the way you catch a cold. And what I propose in my book is that the most anxious person in the room always has the most power, unless there's a non-anxious leader, what Bowen would term a differentiated leader. So all of our listeners can, you can already think of a situation. Let's take it out of your family and put it in a staff meeting.
Yeah.
You already know how people are relating to each other. Who's always speaking up? Who in your staff never speaks up but always has their own secret meeting after the meeting? These patterns are predictable and recurring.
Right.
And Bowen helped us to notice how we can look on that level. And then Edwin Friedman was really the first of Bowen's students to take this theory off the counseling couch and put it into organizational leadership. Uh-huh. By the time Friedman died, he was actually consulting Colin Powell and the Joint Chiefs of Staff
in
the military.
Wow.
Yeah. So he brought it from the counseling couch into the congregation, and then he eventually brought it from the congregation into all businesses and organizations. Friedman basically said, look, all organizations act like a family. And that's why it's helpful for us as leaders.
Right. And Friedman has written several books. Generation to Generation is one, right?
That's his book on,
I read that one.
Congregational leadership. Yep.
Right. I read that early in as a pastor, and I need to go back to that one because I didn't have enough experience to really know what he was getting at yet.
Friedman is a genius, but I don't think he's a great writer. It's a terrible
because
I'm the grasshopper and he's the teacher, but I think he's a genius, but he is hard to read sometimes.
Okay. So I probably need to just go back to it and try again. And then Failure of Nerve is his other one that I read. And that was much easier to read.
Interesting.
I felt like, but I thought that one was brilliant. And that's the one that looks more at beyond congregations and cultures, right?
Yeah. If Friedman were alive today, he would be diagnosing the political discourse in this country as an anxious, an anxiety system.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Man, that's a great way of putting that. It is an anxious system right now. So can you help us maybe understand so we've learned some things about family systems, let's say, and how do you begin to, as a pastor, as a leader of some kind, how do you begin to use that tool to manage anxiety? What are some things that I know it's not a step-by-step kind of a thing, but I don't know. What thoughts do you have on that?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's definitely limits to a conversation because really people should be thinking, if they want to dive into this, they should be thinking about this is actually going to be a new way to live and lead. And I think most of us who are type A leaders, like I'm a type A leader, we tend to want to get the bullet points so we can integrate it into our existing paradigm. And so at the risk of freaking out your listeners, family systems and anxiety-based leadership management is simply a new way to lead. It's not another technique by which you can lead.
Okay.
So it's not another tool in your belt. It's like we're changing your tool belt. And by the way, you're still efficient. You're still goal-oriented. It's not becoming some hippie that talks about our feelings either. But I would say the next step would be to start to dive into the 8 concepts of Bowen theory or systems theory.
Okay.
There's some amazing authors. You referenced Peter Scazzera, and I don't remember if you did that before we started recording or during.
I can't remember either, but yes, great.
Scazzera and the emotionally healthy work he does, I think, is incredible, and he's been doing it two decades. There's a group, Jim Harrington and Trisha Taylor, have a group called the Leader's Journey. They're systems theorists. They're amazing. They've written, and then they've co-written with Robert Creech, and he has written with them, and he's also written on his own. Creech actually just came out with a book, Family Systems in Congregational Leadership, that I would say is the best book right now on how to apply systems theory as a lead pastor if you're a preaching pastor. Because he puts it in, Creech did an incredible job. He put, how does family systems show up in how you prepare a sermon? You know, even gets down to that granular level.
Wow.
And then I have attempted a book that is my attempt was to make a primer. Like if you're going to read one book that introduces you, I was trying to write that book. And what I didn't realize until after I published, now that I'm in deep conversation with a lot of these people, is I actually accidentally wrote some things that are unique that I didn't realize were unique. Like the environmental sources. I think I'm the first person to attempt a theology of anxiety. I do a whole chapter on the spiritual nature of anxiety. I was trained in a tool in my 20s called second order change, which I thought was commonly known and isn't. So I write about that.
Yeah, that's good. And I'll just say it is a great book. And I listened to the audiobook first, and you know, when an audiobook is that good, then I'm like, well, I need to get the hard copy.
Oh, that's
it actually just arrived over the weekend. Yeah, and I just started reading it so that I could have my underlines and all that. And I do think it's a, as I was listening to it, I thought, man, this would be great for like discussion with elders and staff and that kind of thing, just to get into. I'm an interim pastor right now. And wow. So, and it's the first time it's the first time I've served as an interim pastor. Excuse me. I'm more aware of the interpersonal dynamics and these triangles. And we've had some conversations just briefly about, you know, with the leaders, elders and deacons and so forth about triangles and boundaries and one of the gifts of being an interim pastor, I feel like, is I can kind of sit outside a little bit.
That's right.
Ronald Heifetz uses the language of being on the balcony and on the dance floor. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
That's great.
Sometimes you have to be on the dance floor and kind of part of the dance, but then every now and then you have to get up on the balcony and get perspective on how that dance is going. And so I feel like I can sometimes better get that perspective and just observe and say, hey, let me share with you all what I'm observing right now. Have you noticed that there's this triangle here? Who's in the triangle there? Oh yeah, me and me and me. Anyway, such good stuff for leading in that way. The other thought I had as you were talking was, if I remember Friedman's writings correctly, really kind of what he says is, what you need to change is yourself. Yes. And that in itself changes the system. Is that right?
Great. Yeah. I love everything you're saying, especially the way you captured the unique challenge of being an interim. You're not quite in the system, but you can't be that guy that shows everything that's sick, you know, about the system. You can't, that's just obnoxious, but that's right. Friedman and Friedman took it from Bowen, and now, you know, Jim Harrington and Tricia and we're all taking it from Friedman.
Right.
It's known as differentiation. It's one of the concepts. Mm. It's one of the eight concepts of Bowen theory. I think it's the most nebulous. I think it's the most difficult, but it's also the foundation. Mm. So there's an author named Roberta Gilbert. She writes really well about systems theory, and she calls it the cornerstone concept. She has a whole book on differentiation. Mm. And basically all it is your ability to notice when you're getting infected by someone else's anxiety and how to stop your anxiety infecting someone else so that you can be the first person in a system to stop being reactive. And it's difficult, and it's a lifelong process, and there are some very technical tools you can use. And, you know, we use it in our family all the time. I use it in church leadership all the time.
You use the tools or the just differentiation?
Yeah. Like I practice differentiation as part of my job. Like I try to grow in my ability to be differentiated. I try to measure when I'm being too reactive. And so there's kinds of ways, you know, if you find yourself always mad, if your mental punishment for somebody's leadership crime don't match, you know, like Leviticus, God says eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, but you want to take their head off because they were late to a meeting again. You know, that's an anxious response you have. And a differentiated leader, rather than telling somebody off, is able to manage their own anxiety, quell it, and then meet with that person and say, hey, in a very calm way, in a very non-aggressive way, say, hey, I want you to know you and I are in this pattern where you're always late and I always let you get away with it. But I just want you to know it's not good because I then go away and I fester and I mentally have an anger fantasy about you, and that's not healthy. So can you and I together help solve this problem? Because the problem is I'm not going to lower my value of being prompt. Like that's part of the problem here is I value promptness. I feel disrespected when you're late, et cetera, et cetera. And so a differentiated leader is able to have a very sensitive conversation with someone without threatening and blaming them. And it's quite a skill.
Yeah. That's good. And that's hard. Yeah. I'm thinking of people that I need to have conversations like that with. I'm like, oh gosh,
It's hard. And it isn't, I got to just say, Marcus, that a healthy leader will allow people to have those difficult conversations with you. Like why I love family systems theory is it's not that the leader is the Yoda and the guru. We're all in this together. So my team has these same difficult conversations with me. I'll have people on my team who work for me and come and say, hey, here's how your behavior is impacting us in a, here's how you're making us anxious. I think a healthy leader is able to have a very open culture where we can communicate to each other on this level in a non-threatening way. But it's certainly not where the leader goes and says, here's all the problems you're doing that drive me crazy. A healthy leader is also saying, I'd like to hear the impact of what I'm doing on you.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Let me just kind of ask one last question. And just kind of in terms of maybe the role of the Holy Spirit in all of this, and the way God can use this to shape us and to form us, so spiritual formation related. How have you experienced God at work through, family systems and all of this in your family or in your churches or, wherever you've served? And how has that shaped you personally in your spiritual life?
I love that question.
Your relationship with God.
That's a great question. I think there's so much gospel in systems theory. Like Murray Bowen, to my knowledge, was not a believer in Jesus Christ. And again, I've attempted in my book to show where the gospel comes alive, where there's actually gospel power we've ever never accessed it before. So in short, I would say that chronic anxiety is a sign that we're depending on our false self instead of depending on the cross of Jesus Christ. Mm. And that's a big topic that I don't think I can honor in a few minutes, but that means that anxiety goes from being a liability to an asset. Because if you can notice when you're anxious, you can say, wait a minute, I think I'm depending on something other than Jesus for my identity. I think there's an opportunity for me to be invaded by the grace of God right now in this moment. So I'll just say I have encountered the visceral grace and love of God so much deeper in this work than others. Two of the signs that family systems theorists look for is when you're stuck. And two of the signs that you're stuck is when your solution to a problem is either more of the same or your other solution is try harder. And where I see, particularly American Christianity, we believe the lie that one more Bible study will do it, that if we just pray more, we'll be more spiritual. And so I think actually this way of looking at life actually helps you encounter a level of grace and a level of freedom in Christ, because that more effort, more Bible study, more prayer, it's not going to get, it's you're stuck spiritually.
Right.
I believe this is actually a strong journey of freedom. That's what I've experienced. And I'll just close by saying that my theology of anxiety, and this is me, I may be wrong on this, but as I've studied the nature of anxiety, I think what happens is it competes with God for the same space in our awareness. So it's very hard for us to be aware of God's presence when we're anxious. It actually it doesn't displace God. I'm not saying that God's not with us when we're anxious. What I'm saying is our ability to notice that God is present is diminished when we're chronically anxious. And so we end up depending on something other than God when we need God the most. And so back to those early days when I was a chaplain, I believed it was on me. I'd walk into those rooms and I believed it was all on my shoulders. And what I had to, and that's because anxiety taught me that message. But when I learned to die to it, I actually discovered, wait a minute, like God was in this room before I walked into it. So I'll just close, Marcus, by saying, like, if you have listeners who are walking into a difficult meeting today or this week, and their solution to that difficult meeting is to worry about it, right? Like some of your listeners are preempting the meeting by trying to worry about every possible outcome. The better news, that's bad news. That's false self. The better news is God is in that meeting. God is ahead of you. As you walk into that meeting, God is already doing work, and your job isn't to carry it. It's to attend to what God is doing. That's a whole different level of freedom than anxiety presents.
Oh man, that was good. That was great. And I've got all kinds of thoughts that we could talk for another hour right now.
I know, it's a big topic.
That's so good. Well, I'll tell you what, how can people find your book? How can they find you online? Where would you direct folks to learn more about what we're talking about today?
Yeah, my book is sold anywhere books are sold. You can get to it through my website. Okay. My website is stevecusswords.com. The best application of this,
which is a great name for that's just a great name for a website.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, good name for a pasta. Yeah. I do all kinds of workshops. I'm actually cooking up a conference in 2020, a 2-day conference, and it's going to be like a teaminar where if you bring people, you'll sit around a round table together and you'll actually work through this in your own team. Because the way my book came about is I've been teaching this for years, and about 8 years at my church I do classes, and then a friend of mine got a hold of it and helped me publish, which was amazing. But the only way this material really works is in dialogue with someone you trust. I'm thinking, okay, in 2020 I'm actually going to put together a conference and people can come in 2 days.
Cool.
So all of that will be on my website. So basically, if people are interested in that, you can sign up on the email list, and I'll let you know when I set a date. And then the podcast is my attempt to do a dialogue, so people can listen in on a dialogue. Yeah. And that's all at my website. Yeah. You can find all of that at the website.
Okay, awesome. Hey, well, thank you so much for being here today and for sharing all this really good stuff. And I would say to everyone listening, the book is fantastic. Just great for your own leadership development and for, just working in teams and wherever it is that you're working. So anyway, thanks, Steve.
Oh,
thanks
for being here. Thanks for having me on.
Wow, wasn't that a great conversation and just so, so helpful. I think one of my favorite statements that Steve made was that the most powerful person in the room is generally the most anxious person in the room, unless the room is being led by a non-anxious leader. And as I was thinking about this and thinking about what to say here at the conclusion of this episode, I started thinking about what happened at my last church, which ended really painfully, and it occurred to me, wow, it's really true. The most powerful person in that scenario was the most anxious person. There was so much anxiety. And it stirred up all kinds of anxiety in the whole system of that congregation. And I will admit, I probably responded with anxiety more than once, and probably would have done well to manage my own anxiety a little bit more. But so important. We need to be self-aware, right? Recognizing when our own anxiety begins to emerge. And if we're not able to manage our own anxiety, somebody else, right? The person with the most anxiety is going to end up running the show. And I'm just not convinced that that's what God wants for our churches, right? For the most anxious person to be leading God's people. I really want to encourage you to check out Steve's book, Managing Leadership Anxiety, as well as his podcast, also called Managing Leadership Anxiety. And if you'd like to check out more about Steve, you can check out his website, stevecusswords.com. And then you can also follow him on Twitter and Instagram. And his handle is @stevecusswords. And I'll include links to all of these in the show notes. Well, finally, if you haven't had a chance to leave a rating for this podcast on Apple Podcasts, I would be so grateful if you would go ahead and do that. Just take a moment. I'll leave a link in the show notes. And if you could go and leave a rating and a review, that would be so awesome. Well, thanks so much for being here again. And I will see you next time here on Spiritual Life and Leadership.